Jackalope here performing for you live on WKAR's Current State, where it's a live Music Friday. Charlie Richardson, David Stowe, and Mike Lawrence here in Studio S, and we're glad they're aboard today. Lots more from Jackalope here coming up in just a little bit. They're more than just a picture postcard. They actually create music. It's Current State on WKAR. Glad you're along as well here on Friday. At the top of our program today, there's no shortage of talk here in Michigan about renewable energy. But despite any efforts to grow green, our state is still very dependent on fossil fuels. Recently, a Traverse City-based oil and gas company has been looking at an area in and around the city of Mason as a possible drilling site. West Bay Exploration already operates two petroleum wells in Ingham County, both near Leslie. Now the company's talking about subsurface lease rights with some Mason residents, and about half have already said they're open to the offer. Around 20 have signed agreements. Joining me now are two guests. Democrat Tom Cochran represents Mason in the Michigan House of Representatives. Welcome back, Tom. And Dr. Jack Carmichael is a Mason resident who's thinking the issue over and involved. Welcome to Current State, Jack.
Thank you very much, Mark. Great pleasure to be here with you this morning, and I want to say that I'm representing no one except myself, and I'm pleased to share my view with your audience.
Very good. We also want to make clear that West Bay has not applied to the state for any permit to drill so far, so we endeavor not to misrepresent anybody in this discussion. Jack Carmichael, when did you first become aware that this company, West Bay, was interested in Mason?
Mark, the first I heard of West Bay was when a neighbor appeared at our door nearly 2 weeks ago. She had the news that an oil company representative had knocked at their door and wanted them to sign over the oil and gas rights beneath their property through a leasing agreement. It was already neatly typed with both the names of the property owners filled in.
What was your reaction?
Well, I was startled. I had never heard of the West Bay Exploration Company, and I found out that they're going house to house in Mason, operating under a peddler's license that they obtained from the city of Mason. I guess West Bay is attempting to obtain leases from property owners for the oil and gas rights under their properties. And as near as I can tell, no information has been forthcoming on the implications of this proposed exploration, except that disseminated by West Bay themselves.
And you were contacted by them as well. What was your response?
I told them that we had grave concerns about the process of oil and gas exploration under the city of Mason. And I felt, and I still feel, that an environmental impact study needs to be made. I think that the Department of Environmental Quality needs to do more than just go through the permit process of granting West Bay the permission to proceed with the project if they have enough residents sign on. They need to actually do an environmental impact assessment to help protect the citizens of Mason. For example, what about the noise? No one has talked at all about the noise level of the project. If it's going to be a noisy project, is this going to cause the property values to depreciate?
Has anyone from West Bay responded to those concerns yet?
To my knowledge, these particular concerns of noise have not been raised yet with West Bay.
Okay. There is a group of concerned citizens coming together now in Mason. You are their chairman. You've had at least one meeting, and Representative Cochran was there as well. Any other concerns raised by your neighbors?
Well, let me say that an article was written in the Lansing State Journal about this meeting of many citizens in my neighborhood to discuss the West Bay leasing attempts. But I am not appearing today as a representative of that group, but on my own.
Tom, Tom, what were your thoughts after that meeting?
Well, I think there was a lot of questions that the citizens had. And Jack, in a matter of 2 days, pulled this meeting together and had contacted my office. And I responded informed Jack that I'd be happy to stop by. I went by mainly just to be informed and to hear what the citizens' concerns were.
What did you make of the comments that were made?
I think there was a lot of questions. There was a lot of uncertainty as to what their rights were, And but it was a really informed group. I mean, there's a number of people that Jack had pulled together that live in that neighborhood. There's a couple of geologists, is my understanding. I think there was an attorney or two. And so there's some people that had some concerns and questions, and I think they're trying to seek and find those answers from West Bay and what their rights are or would be.
Our guests today are State Representative Tom Cochran, a Democrat representing Michigan's 67th District, which includes the city of Mason. Also with us, Dr. Jack Carmichael, a resident of Mason, who's leading a group of concerned citizens who are looking at their options as they weigh a proposal by a Traverse City-based oil company to drill wells in their community. Yesterday, we spoke with Patrick Gibson, the vice president of West Bay Exploration. He says that historically there's been oil production in that part of Ingham County. Since the 1950s, West Bay did a seismic survey about 6 months ago and thought they saw what could be some pockets of petroleum. Mr. Gibson says West Bay has contacted about 50 people in Mason to do what they're calling preliminary leasing. About half, he says, have signed up. We asked him about the concerns he's hearing from residents.
Overall, I don't know is that we've talked to anybody who said a solid no. There are just different reasons that they need to reflect on it. Probably the biggest question that we have with all the media attention surrounding hydraulic fracturing today, that's normally the first question is this a hydraulic fracturing play? And the answer is no. Again, West Bay is a conventional oil and gas producer, and the formations that we explore for and drill do not require hydraulic fracturing. So that's probably the biggest concern, and we're addressing that.
So, Jack Carmichael, is fracking a concern for you? They say they don't do it. They just don't have the technology for that.
There is nothing in the proposed lease agreement that would prohibit West Bay from selling the lease further down the road. And there's nothing to prohibit fracking in the original lease contract. I understand they're now intending to add a clause that says that they will not frack. But I think property owners in Mason should ask the city administrator to provide a service by the city attorney to look at any clause that West Bay wants to add that say they're not going to frack. We want to make sure that this is ironclad.
This company's been around for quite a while, and they claim not to be involved in fracking at all. But you would still like to have fracking taken off the table as a future option for anybody who drills in Mason?
That's correct. And I think if the citizens of Mason want the city to take a greater interest in this proposed West Bay drilling project, they should telephone the city administrator, Marty Colburn. He's at 676-5134. Ask Administrator Colburn to place this matter on the agenda of the next Mason City Council meeting. Let it be addressed fully and in the public eye.
Any fears on your part involving fracking, Representative Cochran?
Well, you know, last session, Mark, there was a group of legislators, Democratic legislators, that pulled together a package of 8 bills that addressed concerns of fracking in Michigan. We didn't call for a total ban or a moratorium. My particular bill, in 2011, there had been an incident in Kalkaska County where they had utilized flowback, which are contaminated waters from fracking, for dust suppression. And the DEQ stepped in and said, you will not do this. It's a rule now at the DEQ that they're not allowed to utilize these contaminated waters. My bill would codify that. We weren't able to get a hearing with this package of 8 bills, and so we've not reintroduced them at this time. We're considering that. So, yes, I do have concerns, absolutely.
We're also led to believe, though, that the geology of the area around Mason is such that fracking may never take place because of the geology that exists under the city of Mason. Do you know anything about that, Jack?
Mark, I'm not a geologist, and I don't wish to comment on that area where I'm not an expert. But I would say that let us be 100% sure, and let's make sure that the city attorney protects the citizens by making sure that any proposed lease agreement prohibits this now and forever.
What do you make of the fact that 20-some people or so have already signed agreements? Does that concern you?
Well, Mark, 20 people apparently had signed by the time our neighbor came over to see us for the very first time about the matter. And by the time the West Bay Company came to approach me directly, they had 21 people signed. Mm. As I understand it, they're looking at 200 sites in the Mason area. And according to the DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality, they have to have a majority of people signing the lease agreement before the project can proceed.
That's 100 or more?
That's 100 or more.
Okay. We've got another comment from Patrick Gibson from West Bay. He said previously that the company is not going to do any fracking in the Mason area, but we wondered about the safety of drinking water and whether or not there's a possibility the drilling could disrupt that supply. Here's what he had to say.
There's nobody more concerned with contamination of drinking water than we are. That's the state of Michigan rules regarding how we construct the well, the casing program that we use to construct the well, are the most stringent requirements in the nation. The state implemented those requirements in 1982 or 83, and there's not been a single case of drinking water contamination since then.
Tom Cochran, any response to that?
Well, I would have to take him at his word. I don't know that for a fact. Obviously, we have some concerns. We do have another package of bills we've introduced with some pipeline safety. It's obviously not the same question. It's not drilling. They were trying to get some coverage and a hearing on our package of bills on pipeline safety. Obviously, in the Battle Creek area, we had an incident with the largest spill of oil in the domestic within the state, United States, that occurred here in Michigan. Hmm. So we definitely have concerns.
Well, this company has a history. I'm thinking it might be worth looking into the details of this. Of this history, you have another meeting coming up, Jack Carmichael. Tell us about that.
Well, the meeting that is coming up is sponsored by Tom Cochran. It's going to be called a town forum, and I think Tom is best equipped to speak to that. But I would like to make one more comment before I
quickly,
sign off.
Very quickly, please.
May I be the first to propose that West Bay Exploration aggressively pursue renewable energy projects to preserve our Michigan natural resources for future generation.
Are they involved in renewable energy at all? Do we
know
that?
I don't know, but I'd like to see them reincorporated as the West Bay Exploration and Renewable Energy Company.
Very good. We want to thank our guests. Jack Carmichael is a resident of Mason. Tom Cochran is a state representative from Mason representing the city. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Our special guests here on a Live Music Friday, Jackalope. This is called Climbin'.
I may live a long, long time, but I'll be cut down in my prime. I don't want to go back downhill. I've been there and I've had my fill. I'll keep climbing. I'll keep climbing. I'll keep climbing. Rung by rung. What goes up must come down, but I can't stay here on the ground. Give me a hammer and a bag of nails, I'll build me a ladder that's off the scale. I'll keep climbing. I'll keep climbing. I'll keep climbing. Rung by rung. Maybe happy life is just a labor of love. Final rung, I'll count to ten, climb back down and do it again, 'cause I like climbing. I like climbing. I like climbing. Rung by rung. Rung by rung. Rung by rung.
Charlie Richardson, David Stowe, and Mike Lawrence, it's Jackalope here on a Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. Guys, sounding great. Many thanks for being here this morning. Appreciate it a lot. I'm Mark Bayshore. We've all whiled away a few idle minutes online, lost in fascination over aerial imagery. It's fascinating being able to zoom in on your own house and then drag your mouse to the other side of the world. There are many practical applications for digital aerial photos, of course. Here in Michigan, state officials have recently wrapped up an annual mission to photograph 12,000 square miles of the state. There are many reasons for this project, and Current State's Kevin Lavery is here to tell us more. Which agency is it that's behind this, Kevin?
Mark, it may seem unlikely to you at first, but after all, technology is part of the Michigan Department of Technology Management and Budget. There's a program called MySail that stands for the Michigan Statewide Authoritative Imagery and LIDAR Program. We'll explain LIDAR in a few minutes. I spoke with Everett Root about this. He's an outreach specialist with DTMB, and I asked him what kind of resources it takes every year to take so many photos of our state from the air.
It varies from year to year. It depends on the area, the amount that we're going to collect. We usually work by county. We collect anywhere from 15 to 20 counties per year, about 12,000 square miles. We have a contract with Sanborn Map Company, and they're responsible for bringing the planes and the crews to Michigan to get the work done in a timely way. The photography has to be collected in the spring when there's no leaves on the trees, no ice on the lakes, no snow on the ground. It's got to be a clear, sunny day, and no clouds, no moisture on the ground, no wet pavement and so on. And they'll have anywhere from, you know, depending on the weather, on a good day, they may have three or four airplanes here flying at varying altitudes, depending on what type of image they're actually collecting, because there are different products that can be purchased through the contract. So, yeah, there's a crew of two on each plane. The sensors they use cost up to $1 million. These are twin-engine planes flying at 200 to 300 miles per hour. And they'll be up basically from 9 to 5 on a good clear day.
You've got some very tight parameters there about the atmospheric conditions, the time of year, whether it's cloudy, moisture. You've got a very short window in which to do this every year.
Yes. In Michigan, the industry has told us there's about 10 good days to fly any spot in the state in a year. So when we're flying in the Lower Peninsula like we did this year, we are done. We've got all the work done. We started about March 28. We got done on April 27. If we were spread more to the north, you know, like, for example, in the Upper Peninsula, they could still be collecting if they had to, if that was one of our areas to fly. But you're exactly right that the parameters are very tight, and that's why if we still have a lot to do and conditions are getting, like leaves are the problem. The leaves have been coming out, as you know, right now, and it would be too late, for example, if we weren't done to do this area. So they bring a lot of planes, and they get a lot done in a day.
We're talking with Everett Root, who is an outreach specialist for the Michigan Department of Technology Management and Budget. We're talking about the MySail Aerial Mapping Program. Now, this is its third year of operation, Everett. What have you learned in the past 2 years that have built up our knowledge base about the topographical features of our state?
Well, my role is getting the imagery done and getting it delivered in an acceptable way, meeting all the specifications, and then it goes into a system that allows state agencies and state employees to use for their daily jobs. And then those local units of government get their copy and they use it as well. So they're using it to map, you know, what has changed over the years as far as new subdivisions, new roads, things like that. The uses are very wide and widespread depending on, you know, the various tasks that the state employees have in front of them. What I've learned about collecting imagery is it's just how important it is for communication and having a good vendor and a good project manager and having the planes and the crews here on time and having all the technology work as it's supposed to.
Have we seen any fairly substantive or dramatic changes in the land formations? Certainly we have cyclical things that happen in our state, forest fires and that kind of idea. I mean, any real changes that you notice on these maps from year to year that speak to how we have to plan things in our state because of the way things look on the ground?
Yeah, probably development is the biggest one, especially a lot of communities fly every 5 years. So this year we flew a large area of southeast Michigan and central Michigan. So we got Lansing and Ann Arbor and Detroit and all those communities in that area. And most of those communities haven't been done since 2010. So they're going to see a great deal of change through development, road construction, road destruction. Some of the activities going on in Detroit will show up in 2015 that, you know, so they can look at the change between 10. This change from 10. So that's probably the biggest thing. Natural features-wise, when we get in northern Michigan, again, it's probably about every 5 years. So the Department of Natural Resources can look at things on state land and state forests and maybe changes around some of the inland lakes. And then the coastal people, they use the staff that are responsible for coastal zone management. They like to look at changes along the dunes and what maybe people have done along the Great Lakes shoreline from a man-made structure perspective.
Tell me how the LIDAR system works. That's the light detection and ranging. I read a little bit about this. This sounds like something even James Bond would be envious of.
Yeah, well, that's technology that's been around for quite a while, but it continues to advance. The sensor that we have working in the state today collects about twice as much data in the same amount of time as the older sensors. It's up in the UP today as we speak, collecting around the pictured rocks, for example. And so that's collecting. It shoots out, I believe it's about 700,000 or 800,000 pulses per second, and those are then returned to the sensor, and the measurement is captured as to how long it took to come back. So if it hit the top of a tree, we'll know it hit the top of a tree. If it hit the ground, or if it hit a car, or if it hit a roof on a structure, you know, that all is collected, and once it's processed and delivered, we can pull those features out of what we call a 3D point cloud. So it captures an XY location and it captures a Z value, which is the elevation, so how far off the ground. And then you just compare that to all the points that did hit the ground, and you can do just a lot of work with all that data.
Boy, I wish I paid more attention in ninth grade algebra.
There's a lot of math involved.
I'm sure there is. And the beam of light that's emitted from this sensor, something like 500,000 pulses of light per second.
Yes. Yep, that's exactly right. And that increases with the technology. Again, the sensor that's in use in the state today is built by a company called Leica, and it's the first one purchased in North America by this company, and it's in use. It's in use here. It's the only one, I believe, that they've sold in North America this year. And that's the one that is, I mean, the previous sensors put out a lot as well, but this is a percentage increase. And it just improves efficiency. They can fly a little faster, a little higher, fewer flight lines, and we're getting more data in a shorter time span.
We're talking with Everett Root, who is an outreach specialist for the Michigan Department of Technology, Management, and Budget. We're talking about the MySail aerial mapping program. Everett, for so many years, we've been used to going online and using tools like Google Maps, to name one, and other aerial surveillance images. They're pretty commonplace on the web now. Now we're seeing increasing controversy about the expanded use of drones. And I'm wondering if this application, MySail, has raised any privacy concerns. How do you do a very vital job without the perception that perhaps the state of Michigan is spying on its own citizens with this eye in the sky?
Well, you're exactly right. We get the occasional inquiry as to what's the purpose of this, but it's something that's been going on for years. I mean, there's an imagery archive available for the state of Michigan that goes back to 1937, and it's just a natural thing that's it's evolved into something that, again, for example, state employees use on their daily work. So they're just using it to do a better job of things that they need to do anyway, finding out where forests are, water features, local units of government look at it for structures and so on. It's used in an efficient manner, allows people to do their job a little bit better. And usually once you explain all that and people are getting used to seeing it, we haven't really had any controversy over our project.
In the future, I understand you'd like to use something called oblique imagery, which produces pictures at a 45-degree angle. What's the advantage of that?
That allows for a user to bring in, imagine looking at you'll see it a little bit today when you zoom into a Bing or a Google and they have what they call their oblique or bird's eye. And you can see buildings from all four sides, for example. But because of the technology that's used in the collecting of the image, you can use software tools on your desktop to take measurements. You can use that photo to measure the height of a building, the area of a roof, the height of a tree, and capture things from the image that ordinarily a worker may have to go out in the field and do that and take a lot more time.
So it gives you more of a perspective of depth and three dimensions in a way that simply looking at an aerial shot of a building from a vertical 90-degree angle, something you can't tell from that then.
Exactly. The camera system that does it literally has five cameras on it. So as it flies, it's taking one straight down view, and then it's capturing four oblique views. And then when they bring that back into their processing and put it all together, you can click on a point on a map and it'll show you all five views of that point, be it a house or a lake or whatever it is, or an intersection in a road. And it just allows you to then use your software tool to sort of circle that object and map it or measure it or review it in whatever way you need to.
It sounds like you've seen quite a few of these photos in the last couple, 3 years as they're getting processed. What's been the most interesting thing you've seen in these pictures? Has there been any feature, anything you've seen in these shots that makes you say, huh?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of natural features in the Upper Peninsula that you really get a nice perspective of from the air. Some of the larger mines, for example, or say at Tequamanon Falls, is very interesting. One of the things that we did capture this year is we got over Comerica Park twice, actually, during day baseball games. So we're very curious to see how those are going to turn out. Because some of this data today, it could be poster quality, you know, if you bring it into an image software and do some work on colors and so on, get it run through a nice printer. Because we've done Southeast Michigan, we've gotten over Spartan Stadium and U of M Stadium, Wayne State, Eastern. Those quite often are some of the most interesting features to see from the air.
So over Comerica Park, can you tell which hand signals the catcher is relaying to Justin Verlander? Any trade secrets you can divulge?
You couldn't see that, but at the moment the photo was taken, Tigers were in the field and there was a left-handed batter up because we could see that shift was on.
Oh my gosh, that's incredible. Everett Root is an outreach specialist with the Michigan Department of Technology, Management, and Budget. We're talking about the MySail Aerial Mapping Program, that stands for the Michigan Statewide Authoritative Imagery and LIDAR Program, which is now in its third year. Everett, fascinating topic. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Jackalope on Current State's Live Music Friday. They specialize in country, blues, and Western Americana, and more from Jackalope coming up on the program. Also coming up, we've had rain here on Earth for a couple billion years, but recently scientists are beginning to think pollen from plants may have something to do with the formation of raindrops. We'll talk with atmospheric researcher Dr. Allison Steiner about her study. Plus, you've been enjoying their sound all throughout the show. Jackalope, more from the band coming up. We'll chat with the guests. That and more coming up on a Live Music Friday after the break.
From the moment you wake up, through the chaos of your busy morning, Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Protesters have been
through all you have to do, we'll bring you all you need to know every weekday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
The morning's news on your way to work between 5 and 9 on 90.5 WKAR.
From warmongers to peacemakers, London Bridge to the Great Wall, join me on a journey to the places, people, and events that shaped our world today.
We must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead.
Hi, everyone. This is Mike Worf, inviting you to hear the visual sounds of Kaleidoscope, Saturdays at 4 p.m. on WKAR AM 870.
Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State or on Facebook, Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's a Live Music Friday on our program. This next story is about what happens when scientists get curious about other scientific disciplines, and it leads to new discoveries sometimes. Current State's Melissa Benmark is here to fill us in. What's up, Melissa?
Well, Mark, this is a little bit complicated, but bear with me for a second. Okay, think about an everyday substance like pollen. There's a lot of it floating around right now, obviously. That's why I sound like this. It's probably on your car windows. You know, you can see that kind of yellow stain. So here's what botanists think of pollen. Pollen helps propagate new plants. Now, allergists think of pollen as something that causes sneezing and allergies. A climate scientist at the University of Michigan thinks that pollen, when broken down by moisture, may actually play a role in helping raindrops form. Dr. Allison Steiner is an associate professor of atmospheric science at the University of Michigan and led a recent study looking at pollen's role in the atmosphere. And I first asked her, why haven't scientists previously thought that pollen played a role in rain formation?
The reason for that is because generally the grains of pollen are considered too large to act as good seed particles for cloud formation. Generally smaller particles, like on the order of maybe 50 to 200 nanometers in size, are important for the formation of clouds. And pollen grains are much larger. They're more on the order of maybe about 15 to 50 micrometers. So that's a much larger size. And that's just too large to be a good cloud formation droplet.
Just by way of comparison, how big, you know, I know volcanic ash plays some roles mostly in terms of reflecting sunlight. Like, how big is your average piece of volcanic ash?
Volcanic ash has a pretty big range in size, but it puts out so it really depends. So the small particles, the ones that are about 2.5 microns or less, so 2.5 micrometers, those are important because they can interact with the sun's radiation. The larger particles also can be important in the atmosphere, but they don't have quite as much of a climate effect as the small particles do. Things that we found in our study is people generally weren't concerned about pollen because of its large size. But what we've shown is those intact grains can easily rupture when wet and form lots of small particles that could have relevance for climate.
I understand that you got the idea for this study in kind of a mundane way. You were doing some cleaning.
So as I was doing my spring cleaning one year and sweeping up all of the pollen off of my porch, it had me thinking about if we can see that much pollen on all of our surfaces, then there must be quite a bit in the atmosphere.
So how did you take that information from, you know, actual visible pollen to where you get to in your study where it's actually broken down somewhat by moisture?
Well, so I knew, the pollen interest started with just seeing it, you know, outside. When I was doing the spring cleaning, it had me thinking about pollen, but knowing that those grains are too large had me do some literature review. And when I was doing that review, I found in the allergy community, it's fairly well known that the pollen grains can break up into smaller size particles. And so from that reading, it got us interested in trying to quantify what that effect might be.
So that's really interesting. You reached across the disciplines to medicine from atmospheric science and came up with this idea.
That's right. Most people haven't thought about pollen from the atmospheric science perspective, but certainly in the allergy community, it's a big topic. And so doing some of the review from the medical literature really allowed us to think more broadly about how that might be relevant for atmospheric science.
So fast forward to the study, you use the cloud chamber at Texas A&M, six common wind-driven pollens like ragweed and pine trees, and you broke it down with moisture. Was it stubborn or did it break down fairly easily?
It broke down very quickly. And what we found, we did some experiments where we timed how long we kept it in solution. And that had no effect on the ability of these particles of the pollen to break up into smaller pieces and act as the seed particles for clouds. So based on those studies, we think that it can happen in the atmosphere fairly quickly.
So that might explain why I always think when it rains, oh, that'll clean the particles out of the atmosphere, but maybe
right.
They just break down and make me sneeze. Is that...
Well, exactly. And actually, that was one of the papers that really motivated some of our thoughts, is it's pretty well known in emergency rooms that often after big thunderstorms, they see an insurgence in their emergency rooms of people coming in with asthma symptoms. And they actually call it thunderstorm asthma. So one of the thoughts is that there's something that's happening atmospherically with related to these large storms that's triggering an allergic response in humans.
Well, now, would this potentially mean that something like a drought would be kind of self-fulfilling? Because if there's not rain, then there's less pollen because the plants die. And if there are fewer plants, they don't give the pollen off to help seed the clouds to make rain?
Yeah, there's a couple feedback cycles that we're interested in. The drought is certainly one that's interesting in other parts of the country. And we aren't really experiencing too many droughts right now in Michigan. But the other aspect is that it could be useful for the plant in terms of transmitting some of that material even further. You know? And then the other part that could be useful is that's another way for the trees to get more precipitation and rain that they need to grow. So there's a couple different feedbacks that we're interested in exploring.
Those of us who are weather geeks have heard of, back in, I guess, the 50s and 60s, they used to seed clouds sometimes experimentally with silver iodide or things like that. And from what I can tell, it's not really agreed on how well that works. Could this discovery that with your study potentially point to a different kind of cloud seeding in the future?
It's hard to say if, you know, you could actually force more cloud seeding experiments with pollen. Certainly, one of the problems of cloud seeding is that you might be causing it to rain in one place, and then you'd be decreasing precipitation somewhere else. So it's hard to say if there are really benefits of cloud seeding. But we're interested in trying to understand how the biosphere might affect that natural source of particles in the atmosphere that could influence cloud formation. The feedback cycles are something that we're definitely very interested in trying to understand. You know, we know that the trees that are on the ground influence the atmosphere in different ways. And we're, you know, it's still different. We use models to explore those relationships. And so now that we've seen some evidence for this formation of clouds, we want to explore that on the broader scales, on the regional scale, to try to understand how these pulses of pollen might be influencing regional weather.
All right. Well, Dr. Allison Steiner, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, sure. Thanks so much for picking up the story. I'm glad you found it interesting.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And it's a live music Friday here on Current State on WKAR. Our featured performers today performing live in Studio S, Jackalope. This is called Rich Man.
Never quite made it off of the farm. I don't winter in a place that's warm. My 401k may be cause for alarm, but I'm still a rich man. People don't bow when I walk by. I look like a regular guy, but my heart's bursting with thanks inside. Why I feel like a rich man. Full as the moon, big as the sky, bright as the sun and twice as high. Soft as a feather, tough as a fighter, smooth as a sip of sweet apple cider. Thank you. watch it hard, and doctor says mine is state of the art, as good as any rich man's. Cupboards are bare, but I don't lack. Garden coming in right on track. Corn and tomatoes growing out back make me feel like a rich man. Full as a moon, big as the sky, bright as the sun and twice as high. Soft as a feather, tough as a fighter, smooth as a sip of sweet apple cider. Coming my way, not as depressing. When I count my everyday blessing, did I mention this rich man's life I get to spend? Best of all, with my best friend, she's soft as a feather, tough as a fighter. She loved me with every heartbeat inside her. As the sky, bright as the sun and twice as high, soft as a feather, tough as a fighter, smooth as a sip of sweet apple cider. Your love made me a rich, rich man. Soft as a feather, tough as a fighter, smooth as a sip, sweet apple cider. Rich man.
Pretty nice. Charlie Richardson, Mike Lawrence, and David Stowe, their Jackalope here on Alive Music Friday on WKAR. They will be performing at the Log Jam in Grand Ledge tonight. I've been to the Log Jam, know all about it. Sounds like a fun place to be, spend a Friday night. Is that an original then, Charlie?
Yeah, Rich Man is an original. We do mostly originals, actually. We throw in a few covers every now and then, things that probably were written, I think our standard is 75 to 100 years ago, that we'll throw a cover in of something like that.
Okay. Thanks for eliminating one of my questions. I really appreciate that. Every interviewer appreciates that. I'm joking. How long did it take to write that song? Were you at work on that for months or hours or what?
That song came pretty fast. I actually started writing it while I was in the middle of recording the CD, I Heard Songs, and I knew that it was a keeper and I wanted to finish it and put it on the album. So that was probably a month.
With a name like Jackalope, you guys belong in a Prairie Home Companion. You know, I mean, you are custom made ready for a Prairie Home Companion.
Yeah, well, this is sort of our audition. We're hoping you can pull a few strings for us and put in the good word
for us. You can hear the program on this radio station, but we don't wield a whole lot of leverage with Garrison Keillor.
We'll be here this summer.
As it turns out. Yeah, that's right. That's right. How long have you guys been together?
What is it? Going on a year and a half, I'd say.
Closer to 2 years.
Okay.
Getting there, yeah.
You must have. How did the name come about? How did you settle on it? It's a great name for, you know, your sound and everything.
I always wanted to have a band called Jackalope to play my music, and
seriously,
my dream has come true.
Yeah,
it's just as I was growing up, I was born in Oklahoma, and we vacationed in Colorado, and I later moved to Colorado. But I always remembered on those long drives from Oklahoma to Colorado, we'd stop at a Stuckey's or Nickerson farm, and there'd be some postcards there, and I was always intrigued by the picture of the cowboy roping the jackalope, the giant jackalope.
Absolutely. That's a part
so
of it.
So it's, for me, it's kind of a symbol of the West, which I love. And
without a doubt.
Yeah.
You have a catalog of how many songs?
Oh, let's see, 40.
How long can you play before you start repeating your catalog?
Probably upwards of three and a half hours, I'd say.
Okay.
We can, yeah. We don't like to.
not bad. So your songwriting and singing played a role in the decision to form a band rather than continue. You were a solo act for a while, right?
Yeah, and I found it hard to keep my energy up for that. And I also realized that other people probably were not going to start recording my songs. So if I wanted them to be heard, I needed to be singing them. And when these guys got together with me, the energy got even better and some new songs started coming. And it's just been a great ride. I couldn't be happier.
Our Live Music Friday guests today, Charlie Richardson, David Stowe, and Mike Lawrence. They comprise Jackalope, and I'm holding their latest CD, which is called I Heard Songs. And we note the spelling of heard, H-E-R-D. I'm thinking of the Eat More Chicken ad on television. I Heard Songs, like a herd of cattle. This is all original stuff?
Yeah, those are all original songs.
Okay. This really speaks to kind of the Western music or the Western kind of sound that you were aiming for in this thing.
Yeah, that's the theme of that one. And so we took all the artwork from a photo shoot I did in Colorado last summer at a horse ranch. And that was a lot of fun, too. So
we encourage listeners to imagine a herd of jackalope crossing the Great Plains of Oklahoma.
Musical influences to speak of here?
I've never been asked that before, Mark. Let me think. you know, that's a tough question for me because I don't know if influence means inspiration or trying to be like.
They're not always the same thing,
yeah,
are they?
Not.
I mean, your favorite album of all time might be one thing, and what you do might be something totally different.
Yeah, I'd have to say influences would maybe be Red Knuckles and the Trailblazers. And maybe Tim O'Brien might come up after that.
Okay.
Red Knuckles, the alter ego of Hot Rise, the old bluegrass band.
Okay. I'm not familiar with those performers, but...
Colorado bands, yeah.
Kind of a honky-tonk sound, but with some swing thrown in, and just good old down-home music.
They haven't gotten on Prairie Home Companion yet, but they're working at it.
David, what's your musical background? David's the drummer, by the way.
Well, I've been playing drums almost my entire life since I was, fourth grade. I started lessons, but I'd been banging on coffee cans and oatmeal boxes before. But I played through bands all through high school and college and sort of moved into different styles of music. I'm really, my first love is jazz drumming. And so I've scaled back significantly to play in Jackalope because it really calls for a much more spare drumming style. But, once in a while I kick loose and play some solos and use all the drums.
There can be a lot of artistry involved in just keeping a steady beat. I mean, that's harder than a lot of people realize, just to be a solid backbeat.
Yeah, and just to get to the point where less is more and you're not tempted to throw in a lot of unnecessary drum fills and show off your technique. I mean, that takes years of sort of, I don't know, maturing.
Yeah. Although we do have David, doesn't have in the studio today, he's a sax player as well, so he'll keep the beat and also sax at the same time.
That's interesting.
And every now and then on some of our songs, we throw in a little saxophone because...
So come out to the log jam if you want to see the the drum sax tandem in action.
That is a show worth seeing, I'm sure. What about you, Mike? What's about your musical background?
Oh, gosh. I played guitar from a young age back in probably the Nixon administration when gives a bit of a hint of how old I am. But my older brother challenged me to play classical gas, if you remember that old instrumental song. And so I picked up a guitar, and that was my mission, was to learn classical gas.
That's some number of guitarists' first real song, I think, guitarists of a certain age.
Right,
I think
exactly.
We can say that. Well, you guys are at the Log Jam tonight. Is that a regular haunt of yours? Or
It's kind of regular, yeah. Maybe once a month or so we play there. Can I say that we're going to play at the East Lansing Art Festival?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
I'll take it back. There's going to be a stage
be at the Art Festival as well.
There's going to be a stage on the east end of the festival this year and kind of in the alley. I think they're calling it the 500 block. So they're trying to get some folks to come down that direction during the festival. So we'll be there on Saturday at 1 o'clock also.
Very good. Jackalope here on WKAR. We're going to let David head back to his drums, and you guys are going to play us out. As usual, I'll remind our listeners that Monday on Current State, East Lansing City Councilperson Ruth Beyer talks East Lansing business, marijuana decriminalization, the future of Bailey Community Center, the Park District, and many other issues. Also, if you've been seeing some strange things off the shores of Lake Michigan, like, say, the Chicago skyline, don't check yourself into the hospital just yet. MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa talks about these bizarre mirages that have been appearing on the Great Lakes this time of year. That and more Monday on Current State. We hope you have a great weekend. We hope you're back here on Monday. It's Jackalope to play us out on WKAR's Current State. Have a great weekend.
Out on the high prairie, alone and solitary, underneath a Milky Way sky. Fetterless and lonely, but freedom brings a lonely. Only a song can satisfy. So set me on a saddle and point my pony west. Music rolling round my head gives my poor heart a rest.